Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Mr. Waters, how you doing?
Good.
Or should I call you Mr. Rivers?
Oh, yeah, today you should probably call me Mr. Rivers.
Thanks for giving me a call. I appreciate it.
I've been on the internet looking up Ford Fairlane and just to remind myself, like, there's some guy who goes on YouTube talking about what a great movie is, but he's like, just mentally handicapped, and he's just mumbling scenes in the movie and lines in the movie just completely out of context, and it's so great, it's so great. It's like, oh, thanks. That's the note of validation I need.
I'm gonna have to find that one now.
It's the first thing that pops up.
Nice. So I just got done, like 5 minutes ago, watching Sex and Death. And that was terrific.
Oh, thank you. I like the movie myself. If a tree falls in a forest and nobody sees it, but yeah, no, I tried.
Yeah, no, you succeeded too. It was great. And it was really nice going into it not knowing what it was about at all. So then when, the list presented itself, I was like, oh, okay, this is going interesting ways. So yeah, it was great.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And quite a cast too. That was really nice to see. And I liked all of your nods to the different movies and stuff, like the Alexa DeLarge and what's the
Oh, yeah,
one? You had a.
every name is something, which is.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of them where I'm like, yeah, I don't get that, but I'd like to know. Fiona Wormwood. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure if I know that one.
It's a very. The director's commentary is very dense. It's very packed, and I don't leave anything on the table. I mean, I do calm down after the first minute. For some reason, I try to get so many things in the first 2 minutes of the commentary, but then I relax a bit. But it is, anything you want to know is crammed in that commentary.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll have to rent it on disc. I
If you ever track it down on disc, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I just
Sure,
watched
I'm
it
sure
on
it's available for 75 cents now.
I watched it via the Netflix Instant, so that
Yeah,
was
yeah.
nice to see. And then I watched Happy Campers earlier today. That was a lot of fun too.
Yeah. I mean, Happy Campers, that was kind of my director's school, so. Kind of, I was learning a lot there, where that was a real kind of, I'd like, real like 3 hour ambitious script that I think the movie's fine, it's nice, it just kind of like, definitely Sex and Death turned out more the way I intended it to than Happy Campers did, but Happy Campers is nice, like, it's fine. It's funny, I was just on a panel in Memphis with Craig Brewer and, I'd forgotten that Brad Renfro's from Memphis, and like out of nowhere, he just brings up Brad Renfro, and like I had a really, and he's like, in terms of Brad Renfro being one of Memphis's favorite sons, and how'd you like working with that guy? And just like, and he get, he was a lot of trouble in my movie, so it's like they all wanted to hear nice things about him. Like, I don't know, he ruined my movie, but that's fine.
Oh, ouch.
And sorry he died and all that, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, I was more into the kid that plays the Macintosh, Justin Long.
Oh, yeah. That was
So.
actually his first, like, I guess he had that one good scene in Galaxy Quest.
Oh yeah, he was really good in that.
But that was his, I hadn't seen that when I cast him, but that was his first. One of his first big roles.
And then I always love Peter Stormare, so he's always a lot of
Well,
fun to watch.
here's the thing. I think you would have appreciated the movie, and I appreciated the movie. Originally, Peter Stormare narrated the movie,
Oh,
and
wow.
even after he got hit by lightning, he would continue to narrate the movie. And I thought it was great. I think you would have liked it, but it was kind of like. anybody who saw the movie, like be it friends, family, or a test screening, they were just like they just couldn't understand what he was saying, and it made the movie a lot heavier, mm-hmm. which was fine with me, but it drove people nuts. So we had to like throw it.
I've always been a big fan of Stromer, especially. The way that the Coen brothers use him, because he just looks, well, he looks so much like Timothy Carey to me, and they just seem to use him kind of in the similar way, you know?
Yeah.
I would love to see him in a Timothy Carey biopic, which I know probably Hollywood is just champing at the bit to make, you know?
Yeah,
so I've got some other I'm easing you into Ford Fairlane, so I've got some other non-Ford Fairlane questions for you. I've got one that has been bothering me. I won't say it's been bothering me, but it's been on my mind ever since I saw the film. With Batman Returns, I've always been curious, and I haven't been able to track down like your version of the screenplay. I can only find the one that Dan Gilroy rewrote. I've always been curious about that film. It seems like there's a lot of nods to Hitchcock going on in that one. Do you see that, or is that just me being crazy?
Geez, I mean, I certainly like my Hitchcock, but, you know, certainly not. I mean, wasn't certainly anything super conscious on my part.
Okay.
Is there anything specific? Or?
Well, actually, there's three things in that movie. There's a meeting in a forest that always reminds me of the meeting in the forest in North by Northwest, and just like how fakey those trees looked when Eva Marie Saint and Cary Grant meet in the forest, and they
Where's
finally
the forest meeting in Batman Returns. Now I'm.
It's been so long since I've watched it, and I tried to find it today, and I couldn't find it. But there was a scene between Bruce Wayne and Kyle, I can't remember her first name.
Selena,
thank you. I almost said Sienna.
I do remember in the script that there was a meeting of force. I swear to God, it's not in the movie, though. That's so bizarre. That's bizarre.
I think it's towards the beginning, there's a scene. Well, no, it can't be towards the beginning, because I think the Catwoman is in this one. There's a shot of the very top of a fire escape, and it reminded me of that opening scene of Vertigo with the hands coming into it, and you know that kind of close up on the bar as the hand grabs it. And then there's the line of dialogue of Bruce Wayne when he's talking to Ms. Kyle. Why am I blanking on her freaking name? It's
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Thank you. When he's talking to Michelle Pfeiffer, and he's talking about psychos, or you know.
Oh
crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to tell you that you said Dan Gilroy. The actual guy who rewrote the script was Wesley Strick.
Okay.
And that line in particular, the Norman Bates line, was his. You know, actually, as someone who uses pop culture references in a lot of movies, I stringently didn't put any pop culture references in my draft of Batman Returns. And I was kind of, certainly I don't mind visual nods to Hitchcock, but I thought that was kind of lame, the Norman Bates thing. And I mean, there's even a Love Connection reference that was dated when the movie came out that just drives me nuts every time I see the movie. Just like, oh my God, why do you have to put that in there?
Yeah, the Norman Bates line stood out so much. That's probably why I remember it so many years later, especially how he says two real people and then he says Norman Bates. And I was just like, oh, that's kind of weird, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't know if it was like this meta thing or what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I try to keep the meta business out of it because it's such a, you know, weird alternative reality to begin with.
Right.
I felt like bringing in any kind of, you know, Gilligan's Island reference or whatever, like, you know, breaks the trance that you're trying to put the audience under. But man,
right.
Thinking about it, Tim Burton doesn't really, he doesn't really pay attention to the script. It's kind of like this piece of audio background. So like, even though he has similar opinions about like pop culture references, like he probably just kept it in. really gave, you know, something for the actor's lips to move on finding it, you know.
And it seems like you were heading down a path where you and Burton were going to work together a few more times, right?
Yeah, yeah. And we had, kind of, you know, we definitely had a falling out early on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, but early on in Batman Returns, before we started shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then by the time the movie's finished, we had a meeting of the minds, and, you know, and I had seen the, you know, the first cuts of the film and stuff like that. So I got to come in the editing room. Then we did, you know, work on Catwoman together, the first draft, the first pass at Catwoman.
Which is great, by the way.
It's, oh, well, that's nice to say. I mean, it's definitely a first draft. People weren't supposed to read, and a lot of people seem to hate it on the internet, but, you know.
I just thought it was so out there, and just that whole, like, League of Good, and, you know, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was great.
God, we definitely Tim really didn't know what he wanted to do with Catwoman, and I think he wanted to make, like, I think deep down he wanted to make kind of a low-budget version, kind of like the first Cat People.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really wanted to make a Batman movie without Batman. So it's kind of like me. And I, you know, gave him a pretty detailed outline, but when he finally got the script, it was just like, you know, I think he was burned out and, you know, he lost interest and then, you know, ended up eventually ending up to Halle Berry. And,
oh, God.
90 drafts later.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a, like, they, like, for arbitration, even though I had, like, not one syllable to do with the finished film, they had given me, like, you know, they wanted to send all the scripts to me, and they sent me this writer's list, and, like, I'm the first name, and then there's, like, just literally 50 names after it. And I'm just like,
oh wow. Yeah, luckily I don't see any of your work in the final Catwoman that came out.
Yeah.
That was rough. That one still kind of haunts me a little bit. And then there was rumors that you were going to work on a sequel to Beetlejuice as well.
Actually, that's what I had met with Tim Burton about, doing the sequel to Beetlejuice.
Oh, that's great.
And I really wasn't, you know, it was kind of like I wasn't that into it. I mean, like Beetlejuice, I kind of had something about him and the first family in the White House, but it wasn't something I was passionate about then. I just went, so it's kind of like, it was, that was our initial meeting between me and Tim. And then I went off and, you know, did the, you know, the masterpiece that is Hudson Hawk. And then, but I got a call, like, kind of while I was in Budapest with Hudson Hawk, that Tim wanted me to come and do the next Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was something, like, even if you do have some qualms about it, you don't say no to, especially if you're on the set with Bruce Willis and you're like, get me out of here. Drive me off this picture. So,
you know,
it was kind of like that. The Beetlejuice thing was just basically foreplay for us working on Batman Returns.
So more of him.
Which I always thought was funny. It didn't get called Batman Returns until, like, way after shooting. But, you know, when I asked what did he want to call the movie, Tim's idea for a title was Batman. Like, he just thought, well, why can't we just do a second movie and call it Batman, and then people will know by context that it's a different film? Oh, you crazy, Jim.
Right. Well, I guess you could do, like, the Aliens thing and just call it, like, Batman.
Yes. Batmans.
Right. You know, I might be one of the few people in the world that doesn't mind Hudson Hawk and actually kind of likes it at times.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, I've definitely get more compliments from that nowadays than most movies. It's weird. It's just like it's just like everybody decided to come out of the closet once.
Right.
It's always had some sort of following Europe, which always made me wonder, like, who dubbed Bruce Willis in Europe? Like, you know, they must have, like, added new jokes or something. Because, like, especially, like, Denmark and Spain. I don't know if you know this great director, Alex Diaglesia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I was in Spain, and he knelt down before me in a club, like, you know, because I had done Hudson Hawk. I'm like, really?
Wow. You know, I didn't mind Bruce Willis at all in the movie. I loved Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhardt in the movie. It was Danny Aiello that I had problems with.
There needed to be one cut of a major character before shooting. And, mm-hmm. Like, I never understood why, you know, what's this guy?
Right. So,
yeah, they just projected the movie out here in L.A. At the American Cinematheque, like a non-ironic, a non-showgirl screening, like a screening of where only people like the movie attended. It was very freaky. It just brought back memories of the premiere and the audience watching it, like, dead silence. But this audience loved it.
Oh, that's great. So, and I also want to tell you that I love Demolition Man, and I can't even tell you how many times I've made reference to Demolition Man on this podcast. I think it's because I'm still trying to figure out how you use the three shells.
Well, it's funny. One of my best friend that we grew up together in Indiana, and he's a major screenwriter out here now. This guy Larry Karaszewski, who did Ed Wood and People vs. Larry Flint. I just remember calling him up when he was going to the bathroom, and I was like, you know, hey, I need some funny future shit. And I'm like, he's like, hey, can I call you back? I'm in the bathroom. I'm like, well, what's next to you right now? He's like, all I got is a pile of seashells. And I'm like, can I use that?
Nice. And the secret of the three shells is find the reveal.
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly what you do with them.
Right.
It's too bad. I had always had a joke I wanted to do in Demolition Man where after he goes to the bathroom, he washes his hands and he goes and it's still the same shitty hand dryer that we have today.
Right.
Like, and he's just like, really? We haven't perfected the technology. And he's just like, has to wipe his hand off with his hand.
Right. You know,
the hand dryer is just not quite good enough. Really?
I really like the, and I know this is such a throwaway, but for me, it just really worked. The fast food wars that they had and all that. And, you know, just those kind of like weird, I guess there's a real cynicism that kind of runs through your work that I just really enjoy.
Yeah, that was certainly wartime doctor, where I was just kind of like, all that kind of stuff came to me on the fly. Because there wasn't a lot of humor at all. Mm-hmm. In the script that I rewrote, and you know, I was just kind of, and I think Stallone was a little taken aback when he saw, like, Joel Silver loved what I did, but Stallone was like, "What the hell is this?" You know, thought I was doing a straight-ahead action movie. You know,
I actually went to see Demolition Man twice the first day it was out. I don't know if I should admit that or not, but it just. It had that nice, for me, I did an episode on The Killer a few months ago and was talking about just how the influence of John Woo in the U.S., and that one seemed to be one of the first ones that really kind of had that for me, you know, the scenes of Stallone flying through the air, slow motion with two guns blazing, that kind of stuff, and so something about it just really appealed that, plus the dark humor, and plus Wesley Snipes just being absolutely batshit insane in that film.
I know. I thought we were going to get a little more flack for, like, you know, oh no, you bring back the black guy from, and it ruins everything.
Right. But, yeah, because there aren't a lot of other black people that are hanging around there, are there?
Yeah, no. It's just like, oh shit, it was all going great.
Right.
But you know, it's funny. Like, I just remember somebody asked Wesley Snipes in an interview, "Do you think it's racist?" Like, you ask him directly, "Do you think it's racist that, you know, that you're the villain?" Just like, and he's like, "I got paid $10 million to do this movie. That's not racist.
So I wanted to ask you about the screenplay for Model Daughter and what the story was behind that.
Well, the model, God, I'd say most of the 90s I spent writing the Model Daughter. Like, you know, like when people, like, definitely the late 90s, I'd say, you know, well, it's because, like I said, I was doing that sequence where I had Heathers come out in 1989, and then literally every script I wrote got made into a movie, which, you know, sounds more impressive than it is when the movies are Hudson Hawk, and, you know. And but it was kind of like every year of the first 4 years of the 90s, I had a movie come out, and then it was kind of like, okay. And you get in this thing where, like, oh, Christ, I better get on another movie before this movie comes out. And then finally, like, after Demolition Man, I, you know, like, said, okay, I got to get back to my, you know, quote-unquote real writing, you know. And I kind of got involved in the Model Daughter, which, you know, is... you know, it's. I mean, you have read the script.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. It's a. I mean, to explain to whoever's listening that it's a, you know, dark comedy about a, you know, the heads of two separate model agencies, a man and a woman who are divorced. They are trying to find the girl for a campaign. They realize it's their quirky, unusual, you know, 15-year-old daughter who's the perfect model. So they kind of fight for her, and it. Satirical, dark comic hijinks ensue, but it went through. Yeah, I mean, it went through a lot of directors. Alexander Payne was thinking of directing, and Ben Stiller, Mike Figgis, my brother, Julian Armstrong. It went through a lot of different people. Just never quite got made, and kind of like it led to my kind of, you know, people thought I was, like, just cast away from Hollywood, but really I was just doing drafts of this movie for, like, 4 or 5 years.
Right.
But finally had to just, you know, it was sad because it was like, I thought that movie would have people forgive all my sins for working with Joel Silver, but, you know, it certainly was, like, I thought I was doing some good writing, but, you know, it just, you know, people don't realize that, you know, especially for writers, that, you know, if you're not being heard from, you're still out there writing, usually.
Right.
You know, it's just like, so it's even then, and 10 times worse now, it's just hard to get a movie made, especially an original screenplay. It's crazy the, you know, animosity toward original work there is. It's just insane. Like, you know, you get called into meetings now where you say, okay, our marketing guy has an idea for a movie. Do you want to write it? And like, hey, I'm a writer, and I have an idea for a movie, too. Like, you know, want to see mine first?
Right.
But no, they'd rather hear the marketing. They'd rather have you write the marketing guys.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man.
And it's like, you know, and, you know, you think of the people who are big screenwriters, like, you know, for instance, Steve Zaillian. I mean, Steve Zaillian, you know, I thought he did a terrific original movie, Searching for Bobby Fischer, that he directed and wrote. And, like, but, you know, you look at most of the work that he's done that's come out, and, you know, it's basically he's a typist, you know, like, hey, I adapted Girl with the Dragon's Head, too. Great.
Right.
You're an amazing writer. Like, you know.
Oh, man.
So, you know, Model Daughter was definitely a bittersweet experience.
Yeah, because I found it to be just, you know, very... You know, just it was a page turner, and I liked the relationships. I loved, you know, Ward and June as the parents and everything. And it seems even more relevant today in a lot of ways, I guess, just because I'm a huge America's Next Top Model fan, you know. So,
well as I.
But yeah, so it really rang true even reading it today. I mean, because what you wrote in, like, I think the draft I have is like 97.
God, yeah. Here's the great thing about that script vis-a-vis America's Next Top Model, where it says, like, you know, it's supposed to be a horrible thing that this girl's being exploited, when now, in terms of America's Next Top Model, like, everybody wants to be exploited. You know, there's no such thing as, like, being exploited. Like, oh, she's got to do nudity. You know, most of the girls on America's Next Top Model, like, oh, fine, okay.
Yeah.
There's always the one Christian. There's always the one Christian girl, but then there's like, you know, oh, you want us to get naked for a sleazy photographer? That's fine.
Right, right. Yeah, those Christian girls are always so annoying. Famous. You know.
We just want to be famous.
Right. Now, I hear you're going back to working with Andrew Dice Clay because, obviously, with the title of your next project, The Dice Man.
That's why I'm so scared that people dig up Ford Fairlane because it's such a misunderstanding. Yeah, I'm afraid The Dice Man is also like in model daughter territory right now, where it's like we did a lot of good work and. But I think nothing's going to happen with it. Mm-hmm. But it's based on a great book, and people should read it again. It's a huge book in Europe, and I thought we did a good job with the script of a guy who lives his life by whatever he rolls on a pair of dice. And, you know, I thought we had done some good work, but, you know.
Well, that's funny. I mean, I'm not trying to be trite or anything, but I'm just saying it's kind of funny because didn't you originally propose to have Harvey Dent in Batman Returns?
I think we floated it certainly, and my God, again, just what we need more characters. even think we had like
that was kind of the problems with those other Batman movies. You know?
Oof. We had a small Robin character too, but like you know, but. Nothing, you know, we wisely decided to pare it down a bit.
Well, yeah, I always thought it was weird because they made such pains to introduce Harvey Dent in the first film and then was nowhere to be seen in the second one. And then obviously he changed races for the third or the fourth, whichever one that was.
Oh my God, yeah, there's been a lot of Harvey Dent.
Yeah, yeah.
Billy D. Williams, Tommy Lee Jones, and Aaron Eckhart.
Yeah.
But, yeah, God. You know, my big thing about I was not a fan of the first Batman film, the first one, and I really wanted to have a scene where the Robert Wool character was tortured and killed.
Oh,
and tied
man.
Tied to the bat signal, and his, like, dead body is flashed all over the sky. But
I would have loved that.
But like Tim's got very short term memory of his movies and like, oh nah, yeah, let's not do that.
Oh, that would have been so good. He was so annoying in that movie. Oh man.
Yeah, I mean I can have some respect that he was probably treading water and trying to you know, make up for you know, that Tim kind of gave him free rein to make up stuff.
But, mm-hmm.
You know. Probably not a good idea.
Yeah. no, yeah, the first Batman really.
I did get to keep the line. You're the one who let Vicki Vale in the Batcave.
That was good.
You know.
Yeah.
Which Tim didn't want to do that either, but he finally caved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of people remember Batman Returns just because it was so, you know, like there was so much hype for that first film. I mean, that was like the example for me, at least, you know, when I was you know, coming up in the world, and just those damn billboards everywhere and just that ad campaign everywhere I turned. And yeah, it was such a disappointment. I think so many people were afraid to see the second one, and then it was just the offbeat humor in it. But to me, I loved it. I mean, to me, that one felt like a Tim Burton film much more.
Well, definitely, I don't even think of it as a Batman movie. It was, it was definitely doing a Tim Burton movie. And unfortunately, the script was tied in a lot to what I thought the hype of the Batman movie was. In fact, the first image of my script was the bat symbol and pulling out from it, and it turns out it's a store that's selling all this Batman merchandising.
Oh wow!
And then it gets trashed in this riot and kind of like, and Michael Keaton's much more of like a, you know, hates people for like, you know, making money off his image and like all the merchandising and all the bad hype. And he's against it, but,
oh man, that would have been great.
although, Although it's funny, what I like about Michael Keaton is Michael Keaton will go through your script and I'm like, yeah, and once I put on that mask, nobody wants to hear me talk. Like, I can't have these big speeches because as much as I really like the Christopher Nolan movies, I mean, when Christian Bale starts talking and doing those big speeches in the Batman voice, I'm like, hold on, let me get a glass of water.
Yeah, God.
Just worried for his voice.
Yeah, that was the real problem I had with that.
I mean,
last
I think
one. That...
Definitely Batman Returns is the favorite Batman movie of people who don't like Batman. Like that's what a friend of mine says. Like, hey, it's a great movie for you if you don't like Batman. Because we just don't really care about any of the rules.
Right.
And, you know, I definitely love the Christopher Nolan movies, but it's just like we're operating in a completely different idiom.
Right. Well, for me, it was so much that relationship that was going on. Well, not even the relationship. I guess just the interactions, especially between Shrek and the Penguin. You know, so many great lines there. And I love the Penguin with his, endless supply of tape and everything and repairing all those shredded documents. That was really nice.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, that's funny that you mentioned that specific part. That was like just that was where, you know, I find working with Tim Burton, it's kind of like you feel like you're working for the prince in the castle, and you just got to keep bringing stuff to him and seeing what he likes. And then when I had the concept of taping together the shredded documents that come in the sewer, he's like, okay. Now I get it. that was kind of like put Penguin in complete perspective for him.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't want to misquote you back to yourself, but just that. Walken for me is just so great in that one. He's just like, what was it like, businessman? Sure, whatever. And then when he's but monster, so good.
I know. I definitely, before Christopher Walken became a cliche, I wrote that part with him in mind. But I've always had problems with, like, to me, I wanted him to be kind of like the Mitt Romney controlling the experiment. Like, this is a real guy who's a villain.
Right.
And then I thought, like, the way he's dressed in that hair and, like, wait a minute, you're making him in another supervillain when I wanted these kind of two outlandish villains contrasted with like this guy, this seemingly normal looking guy who runs a corporation, but instead it was like, oh, and here's another loony.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess in a Tim Burton world, though, that might be as close to normal as you get.
Yes, yes. I think Michael Murphy as the mayor is about as close as you're going to get to normal.
Right, right. Yeah, that's kind of a shame that he bought his own hype there.
Yeah, but he is right to be bitter than most because, like, everybody seems to get two chances, and he didn't buy his hype any more than anybody else buys his own hype.
True.
But like, it's like, why does Dana Carvey get opportunity knocks and clean slate?
Don't forget Master of Disguise now.
Oh, geez, yeah, see?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. Well, I think Dice came back on Entourage, but I don't have HBO, so I haven't seen him on that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I saw him. God, he was kind of, he was definitely playing himself too.
Oh, yeah.
As far as kind of an actor who's fallen out of favor, but who still thinks he's huge and
Right. So, in all seriousness though, does it look like the Dice Man, God, it's so hard for me to say that and not laugh, that the Dice Man is going forward, or is there other stuff? It's really tough. Sorry to get off subject a little bit, but it's very difficult for me when I talk to writers sometimes, because I'm sure that this has happened to you a bunch, that you'll work on something and then you get arbitrated out, so that there are so many projects that you have done that won't show up on like an IMDb or something. It's like
from your lips to God's ears.
Yeah.
I keep winning my arbitrations. It's a problem.
Well, it's like
I got to lose a couple of these. I got to lose a couple of these things.
I talked to a writer a few months ago, and it was like, you know, according to IMDb, you have written 4 movies over 20 years, you know, and there's just no way that you can survive doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the people who wrote the terrific movie that came out last year, Rise of the Planet of the Apes,
mm-hmm.
you know, they are screenwriters who've been working forever, as long as I have,
mm-hmm.
doing great work, and that's their first movie that got produced.
Wow.
And it's just like, you know, I mean, just so many movies don't get produced. Like, I mean, I've done some really interesting, I don't think I have done a project that did come out that my name isn't on.
Mm-hmm.
I actually write really good. I always joke that the best piece of writing ever done in a Batman movie was my arbitration letter to get sole credit. like I've done like an adaptation of Stranger in a Strange Land, the science fiction novel for Tom Hanks, and like back in the 90s, and you know, that was, I thought, a terrific script, but it's like, you know, it's kind of like a $200 million movie about, you know, an alien who starts a religious cult. So, like, you know, they're good working experiences, but it's very unlikely they're going to get, some of these movies are going to get made.
Yeah. Yeah. I would totally love to see what that looked like. I mean, cause for me, that was such a turning point in Heinlein's career, you know, and just seemed like everything that he had been writing led up to that book. You know, I don't think he was ever afterwards, but
yeah, I definitely think it's more timely than ever.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. But yeah, oh God, yeah, that'd be fascinating. You know, and it's funny because I'm one of these guys that loves those, just those cheesy books, you know, the best movies never made kind of thing. And I haven't run across that one. That would be awesome to learn more about. So,
yeah.
Neat. Very cool. And what else have you worked on that no one is ever going to see?
Something I just finished that there's a series of books by this, you know, humorist author, Christopher Moore, who's got quite a
following. Oh, yeah.
But he did a trilogy of, dare I say it, vampire books.
Those are
way
so
before,
good, yeah.
Way pre-Twilight, Blood-Sucking Fiends, You Suck, and Bite Me.
Right.
And I've, with my brother to direct, I've just recently turned in the first draft of Bloodsucking Fiends to 20th Century Fox, and they're very excited about it. Had what I would call my first good studio meeting in many years.
Oh, that's great!
So hopefully something will happen with that, because it really is kind of like, you know, the necessary last word on vampire, the vampire pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think. I really like the little goth girl character in those as well.
Yeah, yeah, I'm from your lips to God's ears. the movie will be successful enough that we get to do that character in the next one.
Right. Yeah, that's one thing I like about his work too, is the interconnected characters, you know, like, I'm trying to remember the guy in the green suit who's got the great name. Oh, Mint? Is that his name?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, do you remember who I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He's in the next.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny though. It's like, you know, the first book takes place just before cell phones and the internet. It's just like reading a Charles Dickens novel.
Right.
Like it's crazy how you just take away those two elements and, you know, the world's changed just on the basis of those two elements here. So you have to spend most of your adaptation time just figuring that out. You know,
right.
It's crazy.
You know, now that you talk about it, I'm wondering if I ever read the first one. Well, because I was going through a whole big period of listening to audiobooks. I had this horrible drive to work and was downloading a whole bunch of Christopher Moore audiobooks. And I managed to listen to, I think I listened to the last one first, listened to,
oh my God,
something completely different. And then I listened to the second one, and I don't know if I've ever heard the first one. So,
well, the first one's definitely the best book from a beginning, middle, and end standpoint.
Okay. So, well, I like the other two, that's for sure.
We're we're having a problem where the head of 20th Century Fox loves the title of the second book, so we may be displeasing fans by making the first book and calling the name of the second book.
Oh, jeez.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Right. Well, geez, I know I could chat your ear off all night. This has been a lot of fun. I always enjoy talking to somebody who's so movie literate, and especially that's done so many great things, even if you're not happy with them. But
no, it makes me feel better. Anything to take the gun out of my mouth.
Right. Well, cool. So yeah, definitely. I'll probably bug you to see how things are going, especially with the Moore book and stuff. Because I really hope that comes about. I mean, you would hope that in this day and age you could get a vampire film made, you know. But
yeah, well, I certainly will test that theory.
Right.
I'm the one who'll write the vampire movie that'll be too too hot to handle.
Have you
and if you do get and when you get that copy of The Day the Clown Cried, you know, give me a call.
Okay, yeah, definitely. We'll do. I'll have to see if I can disobey that writ that I had to sign and stuff. Yeah. I was going to ask you if you've ever read Christopher Moore's book Lamb.
Oh, that's my favorite and my dream.
Yeah.
My dream adaptation, if I can live in a world where I can do that one, that would just be.
That was another one that I listened to, and I know that he doesn't have the best reputation in the world, but Fisher Stevens did the narration of it, and he did an amazing job. It was just really, really good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. No, that book's needed.
Oh yeah.
I mean, an adaptation that is, but.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Thank you so much, sir. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Okay, cool, man. All right, Mike. See you later.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.